We're coming to the end of season 5 of this podcast, a season that started in May. We have focused mostly on writing this season, but we've talked to someone involved in politics, to a filmmaker, to an historian and archivist, to a woman who has ridden her bicycle in almost all of the United States, to folks in Appalachia, to an historical interpreter, and to an esteemed theatrical director. Two of our guests were from South Asia. One of our guests has known me all my life, my brother, Donald Graham. And three of the episodes were about writing, two of them on the pros and cons of generative artificial intelligence. It's been an embarrassment of riches, as folks used to say. This episode, either our last or close to the last for the season, and perhaps for a while I regroup after the holidays, is a wonderful way to end. We have Anne Hite, well-known and well-recognized writer of Appalachia and the South. We will talk about her personal story, her books about Appalachia, and her most recent book, a departure for her, but one that is getting its due recognition. You don't want to miss this one. Ms. Anne Hite, I am so thrilled to have you on this podcast. Thank you so much for your time, which, considering your literary output, is precious. You are so prolific in your writing, and that's really when that's part of what I want to dig into today, and how you got started, and where. What your process is and what your experiences are that brought you to this place, because you've written so many different and wonderful books about Georgia and Appalachia and I think other places as well. So I'd like to start with how you began to write creatively fiction. I know you did writing more of a technical in your former job a long time ago. And you were a mom with 4 daughters. So can you tell us about that time in your life?
If I can.
Oh, my.
I'm just, it's a blur, right? 4 daughters. Well, I've always been a writer and wanted to be a writer. But and I did write with BP Oil, but and did technical writing. And that paid the bills. But for me, I just had to squeeze it in where I could. So my first book, Ghosts on Black Mountain, was written probably most of it every hour of lunch hours at BP Oil. So everybody else would go out to lunch and hang out together, and I would find a quiet office and write for an hour. That was precious. I mean, you know, because I wanted to be fully at home with my kids, too, you know, when I was there. Because I was a working mom, so I did try to be fully attention-wise when I was at home and they were there. So it was a little balancing act, but I'm sure every woman out there especially knows what I'm talking about, that aspires to do any kind of art. They have to find, you know, they have to squeeze in that time. And I learned to be very, you know, I could just turn things off. I hear people say, I can't write in coffee shops because they're too noisy. I would have never written anything. I mean, I really had to learn, because I was that way too. I had to learn to just turn. I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I had to learn to turn things off. And some of my older daughters now will say, oh, I could tell, because I'd come in to the office and say something. That was the best time to ask to do something that you would probably say no, because you would just go, yeah, because you were into what you were doing. So they knew, you know, that I had learned how to kind of just tone out the world. I would have never been a writer if I hadn't. And either I would have been a writer and not such a great mom, or I would have been, you know, I don't know, I wouldn't have been a writer. So for me, I had to find that kind of balance to just, and not, you know, aspire to write this many hours every day. So it's kind of like that even now, you know, now that I'm the age that I am and everybody's grown up and left home, I just write when I want to write, you know, because I got used to just writing whenever, You know, the best time to write for me is in the mornings because I'm a morning person. And I'm not after, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm really not worth anything creatively anyway. And for me, it's better to do that. But then I have written later in the evening if that's the only time I could get in because something going on. So, yeah, I mean, I just think you have to be determined. I was determined to make, to do something. I was determined to get short stories. First, it was short stories published. And then I was determined to get a novel published. And, so I just worked really, hard and didn't take no for an answer,
Okay. Well, let me follow up with a few questions. What was your college work? Did you have some college work?
Just English. I mean,
Okay.
For me, that was it. Mostly, I mean, I could be a student forever. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could be a student now. I love learning. I'm one of those weird people that at school, and I have one daughter out of the four that loves going to school too. And so I could have been a professional student if I could have had away with it.
Yeah.
And it would have been, all these things that it didn't make you a lot of money, wasn't setting you up for, to make that big, huge paycheck, but it was the stuff that I loved. Right. So words, I always loved language. I always loved words. I love literature. I love poetry. I love, all of that. And I just, from a very early age, read.
Okay. So where did you go to college?
I went to Kennesaw State.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. In and out.
Right.
Because I was a mom and was an early mom. So I would take these courses or I'd go for this length of time and put more into that. So a lot of my years where I wanted to be writing and trying to publish, I was also trying to go to school and finish school. So yeah, so multitasking.
Right. Well, there have a lot of great writers who've come out of Kennesaw, so I know they have a good program. So how old was your oldest daughter when you started fiction or creative publishing and everything?
When I started, actually, she was already grown and left home when I started publishing.
Okay.
When I started publishing, because I was a perfectionist and thought everything had to be perfect before I could submit it. And then my mother died. And I think part of it was I was holding back because she was still alive. And a lot of my work is wrapped up in my family, right? It is what it is. And so I think subconsciously I was protecting, the family. And she died in 2003. And I took 2 weeks off from work and I sat down and wrote, and I'd written lots of stuff. And it was, I emulated Ellen Gilchrist, which is one of my very, very favorite writers. And a lot of people, you don't hear people, because she's older now and you don't hear a lot of readers talk about her, but she's a wonderful Southern writer and you need to read her if you haven't and really study her because she's brilliant with storytelling. But, and so I had, I emulated her and I am like, all my, but as far as having a real voice, I don't think I had that real voice yet. And I took 2 weeks off. I was devastated, because my mother died when she was 72, which to me is young.
Yes, it kind of is.
I'm 67 now, so that's
right.
It was young then. And I was devastated. So I took 2 weeks off and I wrote 10 short stories, which was very unusual for me because it takes me forever in that 2 weeks. And I just decided, this is what you're going to do. You're going to send these off and you're not going to think about it a whole lot. So by the time the first of the year rolled around, all of them had been accepted.
Oh, wow.
Which blew my mind.
That's quite a mind.
Because I just didn't think, but what it was is there was no more filter. I was always filtering myself. I think, I'm just guessing. I mean, I didn't externally say, oh, you know, I'm going to filter this out. I'm going to guard this. But I know that's probably what I was doing, because what came out was, you know, hugely different. That there was my voice. You know, my voice just poured out onto the page. And it was very Appalachia. I was raised by a grandmother who was from Appalachia. And it was very Appalachian, which I thought, oh, nobody's going to like this. You know, look at the way they talk. You know, they're not going to like this, because my grandmother was very big on education. She was very big on us speaking properly. The only word I was allowed to not speak properly, which we think that it's spoken properly, is Appalachia. Okay. You know, a lot of people say Appalachia, and I go, oh, no.
Yeah. You know, overcorrect.
And we were allowed to, my brother, I say we, it was me and my brother, we were allowed to say Appalachia. Because she said that lets people know you're from Appalachia, you don't have anything else. So she, you know, she really turned me against the language, you know, the language in Appalachia. And people look at me when I say that, but it's just so true. There is a language there. It's a beautiful, beautiful language, and we're losing it. And so I just couldn't believe people loved it like that, you know, because I didn't write in dialect, but I had them speak, and, you know, they'd use the wrong verb in this sentence and then use the right verb, because that's what we do. And it's not because we're not intelligent. It's just who we are and what we do, where we come from. And I would allow them to speak like all my aunts spoke and all, you know, and all the people that I knew spoke. And so, you know, it just took off, and I thought, how can this be?
Yeah.
But it really did surprise me. You know,
that's awesome.
Working like that.
Yeah. Well, that would be definitely a an impetus for getting to the novel stage, which obviously takes a lot more thought. But I don't know. A good short story, it can take a lot of work, you know, to really focus it.
I found out that I'm more of a novel writer than I am a short story writer. When I write short stories, they're long.
Yeah.
You know, back in the, it was very in the 80s to write long short stories. Uh-huh. You know, like 8,000, 9,000, 10,000. Yeah. You know? And that's who I am as a short story writer. Occasionally I'll write a really short one, but most of the time, I just can't even fathom doing flash fiction. You know, I need way lots of space, you know, to write and expand. And it's just who I was. And so when I actually wrote a short story collection and called it, I forget what I called it now, but that's how I got an agent. And they turned it in everywhere. She said, she put it out there. She said, but we're not going to get it because it's a short story collection. And they want a novel first. And sure enough, you know, Penguin said, you know, we want a novel. She's really a great writer, but we don't want a short story collection. We want a novel. And that was the, you know, repeated throughout. And my agent said, can you write a novel? And I said, sure. I'd never. And I said, and so I took the first short story, which was called Ghost on Black Mountain, from the collection, and said, I'll write a novel from that. And that's what I did. I had no clue what I was doing, other than I think you do if you're a big reader.
Yes.
You know what you're doing. You just, it's internalized because you read so much. Mm-hmm. But, and so I just sat down and started writing it. And then I got to the end of what would have been the short story, which I had expanded out even further into 80 pages. And I thought, okay, but what happens next? You know, it's not a novel yet. What happens next? And then it just, I knew what was going to happen next. And then I knew when I got to the end of that, what was going to happen next. And so I understood that I loved novel writing. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the space that allows me. I don't write really big novels. My novels are average, but it's just that space to explore who each character is, you know, what the story really is important to me.
Yeah. So it's you got these short stories published, and then did you get an agent after that?
After I had the short stories published, I got an agent. And how that worked is they were having a writing conference here in Smyrna. I don't live in Smyrna now, but I did at that time. They were having a writing conference, what we now call the Red Clay Writing Conference.
Okay.
It was called something else, but it was there. They were going to have it at the conference center. So I signed up for it. And you could pay $5 extra, imagine, because now it's like 30 or 40.
Yeah.
$5 extra and send 5 pages. And an agent would take a look at it and let you know their thoughts on it. So I sent the first 5 pages. Well, at the time I had this other book that I was working on that was so proper. You know, it had all the proper language because I was still battling how, you know, the proper way to speak, right? And I had the short story collection over here that I had worked on, that I'd been working on, but I was writing somewhat. I didn't know then I was writing a novel, but it was just very proper. And I went to take 5 pages from that and then took the first 5 pages off of Ghost on Black Mountain, and which was the first short story in the collection. And I sent that. And probably 3 days later, I got a phone call on my cell phone in my office at work. Which is what I had put on there, and the agent wanted to represent me just on that.
Oh, wow.
And I said, yeah, but you haven't read the whole collection. She said, and I want to, and we're not going to sell a collection, but you have a voice, and I want this voice, you know. So by the time I actually went to the conference, I was already had an agent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that sounds real easy. But then the whole thing starts about how to sell your novel and whether to get it out there. So it's definitely something you should celebrate when you get an agent. But understand the road can still be long.
Yeah. Because that would arrived.
I think that was 2004, 2005. And I didn't finish writing Ghost on Black Mountain and didn't put it out there to even be sold until 2008.
Okay.
And then it was 2010 before it was bought by Simon & Schuster. So, you know, it was kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Little journey. You have to have the backbone for it, for sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And I think people have a lot of mistaken ideas. I spoke with someone I just met casually at a book event, and he seemed to think that everybody should be falling at his feet because he'd written novels. And I'm like, and bless his heart, when he would explain the plots to him, I'm like, okay, those are interesting.
Interesting. Well, I will tell you.
Unusual.
My first writing class, I walked in there thinking, this teacher is going to be blown away. She's going to be so blown away that there's no reason for me to finish taking this class, you know? I mean, really, and I was an adult, okay? We're not talking about, you know, a kid. This was an adult. I really thought that. And I think you need that bravo a little bit, but you need to be cut down to size.
Yeah.
And she just tore my... she tore it apart, and I thought, I'm never going back to that class. And, of course, I went back. And by the end of it, she was comparing some of my work to Fitzgerald, which it blew my... So, you know, because I learned that much from her.
Uh-huh.
But she shot me down. First off, she nailed me. She already knew, you know, that you think you have to understand you never quit learning.
Right.
You know, I go and take workshops all the time, mm-hmm. you know, because I want to keep up with the new stuff and the way that other writers look at it. And they think it's so funny because these are people I know that are colleagues, and I'll come and pay for to take their workshop because I'm going to learn something different from them, you know?
Yeah.
I'm going to learn how to approach a subject different from them. So I think it's real important that we never get to thinking we're so good we don't have to work at it anymore.
Yeah.
You know? So yes. That's where I'm at.
That's so true. I, in my former life, in my other job, I was a chair of a department, and one of my faculty she's a very, very accomplished French horn player. Mm-hmm. And she's always getting more training and more lessons from people. And I'm thinking, you've played all over the world. But there you go. I mean,
For a while, I don't know if he still does it or not, but Wally Cash had a workshop that he met weekly. you know, and you paid a monthly fee. It was ridiculously low. And he would have you read a book. You would discuss the book. He had me reading books, and I thought I was, and I am a very well-read person, but I still read books that I had never read before because he put them in my hands. And hearing his take on the book and how the person, the writer, approached it. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was just, for a writer, is amazing to think, you know, a writer approaches it. I mean, he's a very good teacher. And I love doing that. And I still, like I said, I do all of that. Whenever I get the chance, I'm a board member for Broadleaf Writing Association. And at the conference, I will go to as many panels as I can get away with that when I'm not working and helping out. It's just because you're going to learn something. You're going to learn something from these people. So, you know, you don't ever quit learning. You're never so good you don't need, you know, some prep, some new stuff, some new fresh air.
Yeah. Okay, that's a really good word. You've given lots of good advice from your experience. And I wanted to shift a little bit to, you write about the, not always, but some of the more supernatural side of Appalachian life. And mostly it seems to be in North Carolina, although I don't want to say that specifically. But
it is true.
Yeah. So why that part, why ghosts, do you see them as benevolent or malevolent? And in Ghosts on Black Mountain, it seemed like they were on the good side, but capable of the other.
Oh, yeah. So it's true. And isn't that true of all of us? Whether we're ghosts or real, we can be good and we can be bad and we can switch, you know. And that was always something that I explored. But mostly I get that from my grandmother and my great aunts. Mm-hmm. They were amazing storytellers. Mm-hmm. And so while all the cousins were outside playing, running around like chickens with their heads cut off, I'm in the house kidding, because I would just kind of sit over there and be really quiet. And when they forgot I was there, they'd start telling the real stories, right?
Yeah.
So they would tell all this wonderful, you know, ghost stories. And I was not afraid, because this was my aunts and my grandmother telling the stories. And they would talk like these people were still alive, walking among them, you know, and I loved that. And I just drank it up, you know, and whereas my brother was terrified of all of it, I was have a very high threshold of fear now because of that. So that's why you see the paranormal. See, the ghosts that slip into my work always have a reason to be there, you know. And you saying Ghosts on Black Mountain, well, you had, what was his name? It's been so long. The guy that would show up, you know, just be there. Well, he had been murdered, and no one knew he had been murdered. And so he was trying to let people know he had been murdered. He was looking out for other people that were there on the mountain. And so, you know, I had a reader say to me, I think your ghosts are metaphors for the emotions that take place in the book. And I thought, ooh, I really like that. And I told her, I said, I'm gonna use that, because I like that. So, you know, because it is true. They are, it seems for the ghosts that come in there always have a really good reason to be there. And most of the time it has to do with some emotion or something that's taken place right then and there in the living world. So,
yeah.
And I always have really strong women. So, you know, and they try to put me on horror panels sometimes. And people that read real horror go and I would hiss and throw my books across the room, because they're not. They're more folklore.
Yeah.
Don't you think? So I would probably fit into the new genre of folk horror. That would probably be an okay place for me. But most of the time I write really strong women. And they're just, it just so happens that there's some ghosts that are mixed in there too.
Yeah. So. They seem to be, you know, like you said, there was a reason for them there. So they seemed benevolent. They weren't there to be horrifying.
Right. You know? I think Storycatcher would probably be the one exception. That has some pretty rough, it has at least one rough benevolent.
Yeah.
Entity in there. But I was at the time, you know, because we absorb what's going on in our life, or I do when I write.
Right.
Especially in fiction. And it comes, it filters in. And so my mother-in-law was dying, and I was spending most of my time in a ICU waiting room, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And so all of this was taking place, and it just bled into, you know, the some of the ghosts in that particular book. Because yeah. that's a book people say, I can't read that unless I had to stop reading it at night. And I was like, because I have this high threshold, I go, oh, really? I could write you some stuff that keep you from reading at night. But anyway, so they're a way of, I think, for me to almost explore that place that I don't want to go and explore, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's easy to explore them through the ghosts, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much there about what's going on in people's subconsciousness and dreams and other things too with ghosts, you know, as well as, you know, just the whole debate about whether they're really there or not.
So. Well, and I'll have readers say, do you believe in ghosts? And I said, I worked with 8 engineers in BP oil for 12 years.
Yeah.
No, I don't. And I've listened to it all my life with my grandmother. And that's probably why I never get scared, because really deep down, I don't. I think, you know, maybe there are some weird things going on, but then I have a scientific brain that says, yes, but there's probably things that can't be explained. It's just because we don't have the tools to explain them yet. We don't understand what's taking place. So, you know, that's the way I always look at it. Very logical, which, you know, drives everybody crazy because they want me to say, yes, I believe in ghosts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that kind of.
That's interesting. you know, I was not to go off on this, but I was thinking about my own Appalachian families, and they were not one to talk much about that. They'd occasionally, you know, very rarely, but they weren't one to tell stories. And I think that maybe it was they didn't want the kids to hear them, because some of them were kind of not too rated G, I guess.
Yep.
But I wonder if sometimes they didn't tell stories because of shame, you know?
Oh, most definitely. I agree with you.
Yeah.
I do. And my grandmother and her sisters were granny women, so they were more apt to tell stories because they would mix that paranormal with, you know, with religion. They mixed it together. You got the Bible, you got the ghost, you know? I mean, they went together. And that's how, you know, they pull fire and cured thrash and all of that stuff. And so, you know, that all went with it. And that's probably why I heard more stories. But you got to remember, most of the time they didn't realize I was still in there. But my grandmother also told me stuff that most grandmothers wouldn't mm-hmm. have told their kids, especially in the 60s, you know. So, yeah, I just had a unique grandmother that fortunately, you know, she believed in just being honest and treating me as if I were an adult. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it was good for me. I mean, she would let me read what I wanted. And so if I went to, for example, I wanted to read Jubilee, and I went to the library. I was 10 or 11, and I was checking out Jubilee in the library and said, you can't check that out. That is an adult book. Huh. You cannot read that. And so I was just devastated. And I went back home. It was walking distance. I went back home. She said, what's wrong with you? And I said, the librarian told me I was too young to read Jubilee. She said, get in the car. And she took me over there, and she went in and she explained to her that I was allowed to get any book I wanted to read, that she didn't filter books. That to her, it was important that I was reading, and she really just didn't care which book I was reading.
Oh.
That she just wanted. So that was rare in the 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Today it wouldn't be that big a deal, but then it was.
Mm-hmm.
So
as I guess, I mean, you consider yourself a Southern writer, but also an Appalachian writer. What do you think is the difference and what draws you to the Appalachian region to write about, other than your background, family?
I guess because I'm drawn to it because it's just, they're such a simple people, and yet they're so complex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the dynamics are so complex that there's no black or white. You know, you have, even like today, I mean, you have this whole stretch of, and where I'm not getting into politics, but their politics will be so different from mine, but yet they'll be the best people in the whole wide world to me. Mm-hmm. You know, when I go to an event or whatever, knowing that there's this big difference between us and what we think, they still are open-armed and you know, kind, and what my experience has been. That's part of it. Part of it is just the storytelling that has taken place there. I read Ron Rash. I read Lee Smith. I read Lee Smith early before Bakelite. Oh, it's Lee Smith. You know, Family Linen was one of my very favorite books she wrote because I felt like she had written about my family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're not pretentious books, you know, but yet they're very complex. I dare anybody to write one as simple as they feel. They have this very, there's a complexity to the emotions that take place in a Appalachian book and from an Appalachian writer. So, you know, it's just something I've always been drawn to. You know, I don't know if it's because my family did come from there and they go back into North Carolina. That's why I write about North Carolina so much, particularly Black Mountain area. It's because all of my family are from there, and they go back. I mean, the ancestors go way back in that area. And so that always intrigues me. And it's one of the most beautiful places. The first time I ever went, I thought, I'm home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, home. I'm here. This is where I'm from. This is where my soul's from. And that was before I understood how much history I had there.
Uh-huh.
So, you know.
Yeah. I felt that way when I went to Scotland. You know, it just felt like home.
Not to Scotland, but I would imagine since I'm kind of imagining since I'm like 60-something% Scottish.
Right.
That maybe I would feel that way when I got to there, you know, because I'm that much. And then I'm more Scottish than Irish, but I'm Scotch-Irish. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, Yeah,
I think you would. It's just it's a weird thing.
Something that's.
I call it genetic memory, but
exactly. You know, exactly.
I just think you do.
I think I'm always exploring Appalachia. I'm exploring it, you know, because I feel like I'm exploring my family when I do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think for myself, I'm also drawn to it for a lot of reasons, but I feel like it's misunderstood, and you talked about the complexity, and I think that's a big, you know, and the diversity and everything. I think that's a big part of it, that people have such horrible stereotypes, and and I don't want to defend it. I don't want to be like, you know, everybody's wonderful. Aren't these mountain people just so precious? You know, that's bad writing.
Well, but, I agree with that.
But at the same time, I've noticed, and I don't want to get critical here. I've noticed that a lot of people now are writing about drugs and criminality in Appalachia.
And that makes me so angry.
Yeah. And it's popular.
Yes.
Yeah,
it's popular and people love it. And that's because they perceive that area to be just that. And it's just not so, you know, some of the most intelligent, beautiful writers came out of the deepest, darkest hollers in Appalachia. I'm sorry. They did.
You know? Yeah.
And they weren't drug users or any of that stuff. You know, they were, I don't know. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but you're right that it seems to be this thing that's attached to them.
Right. And I'll give you an example. I was up at an event up in the city, the county where my book was written, and my mother and my family goes back to the 1840s. And I talked to some of the other people there who were writers and you know, readers. And I mentioned the very popular book, Barbara Kingsolver's book, you know.
Yes.
And I said, how do you all feel about that book? And they said they, you know, this particular person liked it, but she understood why people, you know, might have a problem with it, you know, with the idea being so much about the drug issues and everything. So,
And the book is really well written. It's beautifully written. But yeah. Isn't it funny that it took a book about Appalachia set with a lot of drug use to finally a Pulitzer when you got an Appalachian, you know. You see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, yeah.
Finally have an Appalachian author get noticed for a Pulitzer, but here it has the drugs and
poverty so much.
Right, and the poverty. And the poverty is real and the drugs are real, but there is another side to everything too.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know.
I tried to read it. I'll go back to it, but it bothered me. It was hard on me to read it. But I'll go back.
I agree.
But the county she writes about is right a couple, just real close to where my family's from. Yeah. So what writers or books have influenced you the most? Is that a fair question, or is that something I should? I mean, you sound like you're so prolific in your reading that it's kind of a dumb question.
I will tell you, and this is the book that has probably impressed on me to be a writer and was To Kill a Mockingbird. And I know everybody does that.
Yeah.
And it's not Appalachian. It's Southern. But for me, the first time I read it, I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I read it and I was just in love with Boo and the whole spooky stuff, you know, and didn't get the other stuff of it. But I felt like this is home. This is home. This book is home. And then as an adult, I read it and blew my mind because there's all this other layered story in there that you don't read as a kid. You notice some of it, but you don't as much, mm-hmm. you know. So it just influenced me because of the voice. The voice is so strong and it seems so simple. Mm-hmm. It seems like such a simple write. You know, Truman Capote's the same way. You feel like it just didn't take them anything to write those books because it was so simple. But that's some of the hardest writing that people will ever, authors will ever do is that makes it accessible to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And yet still has that impact, you know, and the layering and all of that.
It's so authentic, I think.
Yeah.
With, you know, with the way the kids are portrayed and and just it's and not a bit fake.
You know, the time, I mean, I was a little girl when the book came out. I don't remember anyone in my family reading it, but I was little, but I do remember the early 60s and what it was like when I came home to the South, because I had been in Germany, big difference. Like a home to live in 1965 in Marietta, Georgia. Yeah. Mm. I mean, it was like, I probably would have, if I had grown up with it, it wouldn't be that big a deal. But because I had never been there, and then all of a sudden, you know, I was born in Georgia and then gone. My dad was in the Air Force, and then we came back and we were here, and I was seeing the civil rights movement take place and trying to understand it because it was so different from what I had experienced in Germany on the Air Force base, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was, I mean, for me, that's one reason why I think I was so attached to that book. And then, like you said, it's the kids. We all stayed out, you know, just be home before the fire, when the fireflies start coming out or the lightning bugs start coming out, you be home. You know, so we could go and do whatever we wanted to do. And she captures that.
Yeah.
You know? And our kids, my kids, never knew how to do that because it wasn't a time that they could do it, you know.
It's interesting you say that about being in the service, because my husband, who's he's going to be about 10 years older than you, but his father was in the Army and they were in Germany and France. And when he came home to South Carolina, they had the same experience. He didn't understand the segregation kind of stuff going on, you know, and the busing and all, because that's in the military, it had been just integrated.
I'm sure it wasn't perfect in the military.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like that. You had friends and you had people in your class that were, it was diverse, somewhat diverse.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I came back to a place that wasn't. And then it was all up in the air because of everything that was taking place, you know. And, you know, because a lot of stuff started happening in Atlanta around that time.
Yeah.
And hearing kids talk, and I was thinking, you know, but hey, it just people with brown skin, because that's how, as a kid, I thought, you know, because I grew up with diversity, somewhat diverse, you know, and I don't know. So it was hard on a 9.5-year-old to fit in.
As far as a writer about Appalachia, is there an Appalachian writer that, if I can use that term?
Oh, sure. That would be, it's a tie between Lee Smith and Ron Rash. Only because from Lee Smith's point of view, I get it's simpler and calmer. And from Ron Rash, I get all the darkness.
Yeah. Yeah,
which I love him too. You know, I love reading his work because he delves into that dark side of things, and the way that he writes. You know, he'll write a poem, and then he's not quite through with it. So then he'll write a short story about the poem, and then he's not quite through with it, and he writes a novel about the poem. And I love that whole process. Mm-hmm. You know, because sometimes we can't let go of who we're writing about. I mean, I didn't set out to write about the same characters in my books, and I don't call them series because they're very standalone books. And the same characters show up, it's because they don't leave me alone. I keep thinking about them.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I'm sure you know from wrote such a strong character. There's probably been times that you've thought, you know, and I wonder what she did
right
here.
Oh yeah,
in the book. Yeah. Yeah.
That's in my head. It'll get written eventually. God willing, but I don't know. Not next week. So you've won a lot of awards. I could get in. Two are Georgia Author of the Year, and two were being a Townsend finalist. How do you believe these recognitions fit into the life of a writer?
Well, for me, I'm a university press. I work with university press, and that's great for them. So I'm helping them when that happens. But for me personally, it's validation, you know, it's
yes,
it doesn't change anything really. I don't get a whole lot more sales or any of those things, but it's a validation, especially when it's something like the Townsend, because the Townsend is, because I'm a Townsend reader, I've become a Townsend reader. I know what goes into it.
Uh-huh.
And the strict rubric they have to go by. And when I had that, I thought, oh my God, you know, maybe I am a good writer. Because if I've been in I mean, because I don't know many writers that say I'm a good writer. I don't have to worry. You know, we all think maybe we're just not good enough. Maybe they're just being nice. Maybe they're maybe it was an accident that ticked me.
Yes.
You know. And I'm here
to tell
I'm here to tell you, anybody that gets into the Townsend, it wasn't an accident.
Yeah.
But so for me, it's just a personal thing that is validation that says, hey, you're doing a good job. What you did with this particular book was good. Mm-hmm. You know. You aced it for these people anyway, you know.
Yeah.
So
I want to move on to your most recent book, and I'm going to quote a web page of the Georgia Writers Museum. Quote, she has also stepped way out of her box and agreed to write a nonfiction narrative about Lucille Selig Frank, Leo Frank's wife. Frank is known for his conviction in one of Atlanta's famous murder trials and his lynching after the governor, who believed in Frank's innocence, commuted his death sentence to life. End quote. Now, this is a story that there's been a Broadway play about, which is interesting. It was written by the same fellow who wrote Driving Miss Daisy, when I looked that up. And he's an Atlanta person. And then there's been movies and lots of books about. So I know you're very excited about this book. So what was the impetus for you to start this journey of all the research and work on this book, which is called I'm a Georgia Girl. Okay. I mean to say that I'm a Georgia Girl.
This book starts back with my grandmother. What would I have done without my granny? And I got home, we were talking about me coming home from Germany. When I got home from Germany, my grandmother began to tell me stories about her life, you know, and she didn't filter anything, just like she allowed me to read whatever she told me. Mm-hmm. That's a rare thing. And yet she didn't tell me everything either. She did calm it down some. But one of the stories that she told me was that at the age of 6, her father took her to see Leo Frank hanging from a tree.
Oh, my word. Oh.
And this, of course, the people that went to see him like that, he wasn't there when he was hung, but it was afterwards.
Yeah.
So right at 1,000 people, which was a lot of Marietta at the time, came in to see him. And they wore their Sunday best. And I've got pictures of, you know, where they had big picnics and they were celebrating. And, you know, and she was one of the kids. And they brought their children. And she was one of the kids that witnessed that. And it so bothered her.
Oh, that's horrific.
She wanted to tell me about it.
Yeah.
She wanted to understand that this is the kind of world that there is and people will do these things, you know. And you know, she never gave me a real huge opinion on whether she thought he was innocent or not. It was like that didn't matter. The fact was that he had been killed in such a way for her. Because she was 6, she wouldn't have had an opinion about it at that time. I'm sure as an adult, she maybe had formed an opinion, but she didn't share that with me. But it stayed with me. And the way she would always end the story is that the last thing Leo, his last request was that his wife receive his wedding ring. And I was 9 and a half. And I was, kept thinking about this woman who lost her husband and he was hung and he sent his wedding ring to her and she received it. She did wear the wedding ring the rest of her life. And, you know, it just stayed with me. So in 2014 or so, I thought I'm going to write a historical fiction book about Leo and Lucille. And I started researching, you know, because I had what my grandmother said, but then I needed more. I was I had already read Steve Oney's book. Because that's like the Bible on the whole thing. If you want a complete look at the trial, he's the one to read it. That's the book to read. But I thought nobody really talks about Lucille. You know, nobody has given her a voice. I mean, she was this person that was hysterical in the newspapers or beautiful. You know, she was called beautiful a couple of times in the newspapers and that kind of thing. And I thought, this is a woman whose family came before the Civil War, who helped grow Atlanta, who still helps grow Atlanta. Seeligs are a very big family in real estate there, and they own a lot of Atlanta. And, you know, she was a Georgia girl.
Yeah.
You know, that happened to be Jewish, coming from this Jewish community. And I thought, no, I'm doing her an injustice writing a novel about her. Mm-hmm. I'm going to write a nonfiction book. Just like I said, I'm going to write a novel. And I didn't know what I was getting into. And I said, I'm going to write a nonfiction book for her because she deserves it. She was from here. Mm-hmm. She lost everything. She never remarried. Mm-hmm. You know, she never had children. None of that. And so I just asked the press that I published with, how do you feel about a nonfiction book about this instead of a fictional one? And he jumped on it and said, we would love that. And so I spent the next 10 years teaching myself how to write a nonfiction book and doing research. So, you know, wow. Both simultaneously. So,
wow. So other than the research, how did you approach the nonfiction task versus
storytelling? Coming to it, I thought, oh, God, And then I just relaxed and said, you know, a story is a story. Why is a nonfiction story is true? You can't put any guessing in there without saying, I'm guessing, you know, I'm imagining this happened. But it's a story. So, Anne, relax and just tell the story. Just tell it. You know, you've read tons of really well done biographies that do this, you know, that just tell a story. And because I wanted it I didn't want it scholarly. I wanted it obtainable to everyone. I thought that was so important. And so I finally relaxed. It took a while. I'm making it sound really simple. And just decided to tell the story that she'd be proud of.
Mm-hmm.
That she'd feel like I had done her justice, some sorts of justice. And that's what I did. But it took a long time. There was lots of starts and stops. And the more I researched, the more I became comfortable. Because reading her letters, I learned what her voice was, what mattered to her, what didn't matter to her, you know, that kind of thing. And that helped a lot. And reading other people's letters, too, tremendously. And knowing that I had worked with Engineer immediately, I knew when they talked about Leo and how he had such a hard time talking and they thought that, you know, he thought he was better than people, that he was just super introverted, because most engineers that I know are that way. And so I understood that part of him. And I thought, oh, gosh, that didn't do him any good, you know, because they can talk about their work because they live for their work. But they can't talk necessarily. They can't be comfortable to talk about other stuff. Some can, some can't. And I thought, you know, yeah, this is something I just have to go with, you know, and just tell the story. So that's what I've tried to do. And I feel like I've done, from feedback that's coming now, I feel like I've done a pretty good job.
Yeah, I believe you have gotten some recognitions for the book already, right?
Right. I'm right now, this will be the first time I've publicly said anything about it. The book is being considered. We received, the press received it, Mercer University Press received notification that the book is being considered for the Sarah Brody medal. I think which is outstanding Jewish literature. It can be written by anybody. It doesn't have to be a Jewish person that's written.
Uh-huh.
So they have become aware of it and they have plucked it out and said, hey, we're considering this. This is going to be one of the books that we're considering for this medal, which blew my mind.
Yeah.
What those kind of things mean. That for me was like hearing you've done a good job. You know,
that's major.
Mm-hmm. Even if you don't win it, which probably I won't, but knowing that you were considered for that made me understand, okay, I'm a nonfiction writer too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know what I'm doing. So,
well, especially at this time in the Jewish experience, this is with everything going on, that it got that recognition.
The book is so relevant.
Uh huh.
You know, to now is relevant. It's relevant every day. You know, people are still experiencing this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So,
I one thing I wanted to say, and I'll have this part cut out, but one thing I wanted to say was about, I know for writing a novel, a lot of, you know, you have to write dialogue. So that's something in nonfiction you really can't do, right?
Well, what I did, and that's what I'm getting a lot of praise for. What I did there, you know, back then, everything was in the newspaper. Everything. The whole trial, every day of the trial was in the newspaper and they quoted everything.
Awesome.
I took quotes from the trial and worked it in to tell the story.
Okay.
So, and that's a lot of nonfiction writers are saying, wow, see, I like that because that's, you know, but I just treated it as if it were a novel in some places. Mm-hmm. When I had a scene actually going on, but it's all referenced back to the citation and where it actually was said. Most of the time, it came from newspapers. Not all the time. Sometimes it was from letters. Sometimes it was from books. You know, but most of the time it was from newspapers.
And this was in the 20s when people actually wrote letters.
Yeah, well, this was it was 1913 to 1915.
Oh, okay.
They would write letters across town.
Yeah.
To each other. Uh-huh. You know, so there was prolific in letters. Now we would be, you know, out of luck.
I don't think our text messages are going to.
No. We wouldn't want them that way. Yeah.
Wouldn't. Yeah. And their letters were so beautifully written and everything. They were just works of art themselves. So
you could get lost in that research and never write a word. You could just absorb all the history there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yes. I don't know what historians will do in the future for our period.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd hate for them to be using my emails and texts. That's for sure.
Right. Right. Well, and then there's the whole AI thing. How much of it is what people are actually writing themselves anyway? But we won't get into that discussion.
No. And this is so true.
Well, I am so thrilled again that Anne Hite has spoken with us, and I hope anybody that listens to this podcast will post it and tell other people to listen, because there was so much wisdom and so much insight in this discussion with Anne and her career as a writer, now as a novelist, short story, and nonfiction. And I want you to look into and buy I'm a Georgia Girl, and by Anne Hite, that's Hite, and find that and look her up, because she's somebody you need to know as a writer. So, Anne, thank you for being with me today.
Thanks. I appreciate it. And it was wonderful.
Yes. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation. I surely did. I learned so much from Anne when we talked. Please spread the news of this podcast. I need your help. I know what it is to get stuck listening to the same podcast, and sometimes we need to break out of those patterns. If you could post this on social media, it would really help. I'm thinking through who I would like to talk to next year in 2026. If you have any suggestions, I would love to hear them. As always, thanks for listening, and many thanks to Clemencia Villafuerte, our producer. Depending on when you listen to this, I wish you either a happy Thanksgiving, a Merry Christmas, or a joyous New Year. Goodbye.